Hello and welcome to the third episode of Squawker's Football IQ podcast, where we try and give an insight into the analytical world of the game. My guest today is Oxford United's first team performance analyst, Dan Bond. Welcome, Dan.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Good stuff. So just, I think being a performance analyst for a football club is probably a dream job for many people listening to this. Can you give me a kind of a brief idea of how you kind of got into that role? Has football always been something you've loved? How did you get there?
Yeah, I think primarily it's important to point out that as an analyst, it's a lot of hard work working for a football club, a lot more than I think a lot of people expect, certainly that don't work in the game at the moment. Not too much time off, but like you say, it is a dream job. So I studied sport and exercise science at university, Oxford Brookes, and then done a six-month internship with Oxford United with the strength and conditioning coach, which went very well.
How long ago was that?
An unpaid internship. It was 4.5 years ago now. Okay. Got offered the job in the Christmas because the S&C coach at the time left, and I'd got on quite well with the manager. So started a season and a half as the first team S&C coach, and then discussed late on in my second season, my first full season with the club, with the owner of the club, Ian Lenigan, about starting up an analysis department because we didn't have anything in place at the time. And I really wanted to get more involved with the performance side of the game as opposed to the physical side and just preparing the players physically. So he just asked me the question, would I be interested in starting a department up? At that time, the analysts weren't as free and as available as S&C coaches. So I agreed to it and started the department from there.
And it was something you'd always taken interest in, you know, looking at the kind of statistical side of the game as well as just being a fan.
Yeah, I think growing up as a fan of the game, you always, if you're not going to be a player, you want to be on the management side of it and looking at how you can affect the performance directly as opposed to improving players' fitness or keeping players fit, or improving return to injury time, for example. So when I spoke to the chairman, like I said, I just thought, yeah, it's a great opportunity and one that I'd like to take.
Great. And for those of us kind of wondering, as you mentioned, it's very hard work. Can you give us kind of your day to day? What do you actually do in the role? Like, what's your main focus?
So it changes day to day with regards to whether you're in the build up to a game or looking back on a game that you just played. For example, on a flat week, if you're Saturday to Saturday, the Sunday will be spent going through the game from the day before, clipping players' individuals' clips, using software called Sports Code that we've got and we're fortunate enough to have now, and also taking out any bits that the manager wants to see on Monday. I'd have spoke to him Saturday night and Sunday a lot of the time, or any both the coaches or the goalkeeping coach, anything that they want to see, as well as clipping out bits that we'll run through with the players on a Monday morning. So we'll sit down and we'll go through a 20-minute team debrief of every game, regardless whether we win, draw or lose. Which is something that's happened this year with the manager that we've got at the moment who places quite heavy importance on analysis.
That's Michael Appleton, isn't it?
Yes, yeah. Michael Appleton. And he's, unlike a lot of managers, he gives me a lot of freedom to put things together, and obviously it's got to be run past him first before the players, but he does let me get on with the job, which is, it's a dream because I've worked for other managers before that aren't necessarily as open with allowing the players to
we won't go into names there, maybe. Oh, yeah. We can hear that one, but people can probably guess if they do the research. You say you've got the support from the manager at the moment. I can imagine that having the support of players must be a big thing as well, because obviously lots of players play for managers who used to be players as well. Yourself, obviously, don't have a playing background. Has it been easy to get on with the players when you go to them with your findings? Are they, you know, receptive?
Yeah, massively. I mean, I've been in the job for, obviously, I only worked at one club, so I don't know what it'd be like now going to another club. I had that trust with the players when I started the job, obviously coming from the sports science side of it. But it is just about building trust between players. So it's not pulling a player in and always showing them bad clips. It's talking to them in a informal setting. So a lot of the time I'll get my information across to players when I'm just sitting down in the canteen having lunch or sitting on the coach, and it's just building up that trust and getting on with them, having a laugh with the lads, not just being a strict line between coach and player. That's important.
Sounds pretty great. When I've spoken to people about you coming onto the pod, the main reaction seems to be disbelief that Oxford United have a kind of an analysis department, I guess, for people who don't know much about the EFL and kind of League One and League Two football. They're not sure about that. Like, is Oxford kind of progressed further than other clubs at that level in that way, or is it now normal for clubs to have this kind of department there?
I think. Well, I know for a fact because we've got a WhatsApp group started with all the League One analysts. There's only two clubs in League One at the moment that don't have an analyst that's in,
really?
I think, full-time and paid full-time. But I do think that the club has been allowed to progress with regards to analysis because of the manager. And a lot of the times, whether it's right or wrong, and I'm not here to say whether it is right or wrong, some managers don't feel like analysis or watching clips back or the statistical side of the game is as important as coaching or as getting the players in and getting them out away as quickly as possible for a training day. So I do think we do a lot more analysis at my club, certainly, compared to other clubs, but most clubs in League One and the majority of League Two clubs as well, because I've got a WhatsApp group from there as well.
Have you?
After last
year.
Don't
know, Oxford went up last season, so Dan's got the best of both worlds there.
Yeah, exactly. But most of them do have analysts.
Okay, well, that's good to hear. Obviously, everyone listening to this would hope that they do, the teams that they support do, certainly. And how much, since you've been in the job, would you say that it's changed, really? You mean you say that now only a handful of clubs at that level don't have departments, but was that the same 4 or 5 years ago? Has it come on massively in that time? Because I think certainly in the media, kind of analysis, statistical data has been used far, far more in the last 4 or 5 years. Has that been the same with clubs, or has it always kind of been there?
Yeah, massively. I mean, I can talk about the year before I joined, and I know for a fact that gantries were empty the year before I started at Oxford United. And it has just come on leaps and bounds, and the more and more certainly young managers coming through seem to be using it, and it does seem there seems to be a heavier importance on it. And you just have to look at the coverage that's available now. Every Football League club has access to the TV footage, but the majority of clubs will film wide angle, and there's wide angle shares that analysts have between each other, which is just like almost an unwritten rule that you just share your wide angle footage with,
really?
Other clubs, and that's becoming more and more prevalent now that the analysis is there's a heavier reliance on analysis as football's progressing, I suppose.
So you mentioned that kind of match preparation is a big part of your role there. I mean, how much of it is kind of reactive? How much is it proactive? I mean, do you find you're spending a lot of your time focusing on the teams you're playing against and their output, or do you find most of it is about finding your own strengths before a game and making sure you're capitalising on that?
Yeah, I mean, if you ask the manager would tell you that it's all about us and it's all about what we do, and that's what him and his coaching staff do look at. So I feel like I've almost taken on the role of looking at the opposition, finding out weaknesses, finding out strengths that we've got to be aware of. So that'll be watched going through maybe 4, 5, sometimes 6 games, depending on how regularly they play or the trends that you do find, how obvious they are. But I do feel like it's certainly my role to make the players aware of what they're coming up against, because a lot of the time the players will want to know who they're coming up against, what their strengths, what their weaknesses are, like I say. But the manager is very much, it's all about what we do. And if we play as well as we can, certainly in league games, then we've got a great chance of winning.
So you've mentioned that your current manager is very supportive of the work you do, but it sounds like you're the person looking at the other teams. Is he happy for you? I mean, he knows that's your role to do that, and he's happy for you to relay that information to the players.
Yeah, massively. We've got quite a strong scouting department as well at the club, and they're scouts again that the manager trusts. So he'll be in contact with them as well. And if there's ever any times that maybe our opinions on certain clubs come up, then we'll have a nice discussion about it. But it's always difficult. It's difficult when you're going and trying to predict how a team plays, because, for example, if we played a team a few weeks ago, Coventry City, and they played 4-4-2 right the way up to the time we played them, and we'd worked in the week about, for example, getting the balls into the centre forward's feet, and I'd back myself that, yeah, they're going to play 4-4-2. They were on a really bad run at the time. They ended up playing a holding midfielder, and it just ended up making things a little bit more difficult. So things like that will always come up. And certainly last year, when we did have a successful year, it was a lot harder to predict the way that teams would play, because they'd totally try and change the way that they played, because obviously they needed to stop our strengths.
Well, I mean, weirdly enough, I was actually playing Football Manager 2017 at being Oxford United the other day, and you gave me a scout report very similar, where you told me a team was going to play a certain formation. It completely threw me when they played a different one. So if I'm a bit frosty with you today, Dan, that's probably why. With FA Cup third round is coming up soon. And for those who don't remember, not sure how, Oxford famously beat Swansea last season 3-1 in a team kind of featuring the likes of Jefferson Montero, Jonjo Shelvey. Tell us a bit about the preparation for that game, because that must have taken on some serious work for you to have to do going into that one.
Yeah, it was. It was brilliant, to be fair. We actually, with the manager's contacts, without ruining anyone's career, he's got a few contacts in the Premier League, so I was able to speak to certain analysts in the Premier League that helped me out quite a lot, to be fair, with regards to sending clips and sending information. Because obviously, when you're playing teams week in, week out, you get to know players that are in around your league and certainly in League One, League Two and the Championship. But it was different going into the Swansea game because we'd, like I said, the gaffer's very much about what we do. And that's the most important thing. But we knew going into the game that if Swansea turned up and they wanted it more than us and they played to their potential, then it was going to be a long afternoon. But as it turned out, I think the mentality of the both sides is what won us that game on the day, and that was what was most important. Just giving the players a bit of belief that we can do this. We're on a good run at the moment, and that's what won us the game. I think the players' mentality.
And you say that you got help from Premier League analysts. I think people listening will probably be interested to know kind of how you think that the tools that the Premier League kind of departments are using, how they kind of differ to what you guys use. You presume there's obviously a lot more money behind what they're doing. I mean, does that open up more avenues to them to be able to do the work they do? Or do you feel like you're kind of on a level playing field because you've got the clips and the data?
I think it definitely gives them more options in the Premier League because they'll have bigger departments first and foremost. Although in League One and League Two, you can get interns in from universities, there's a limit on what you'd like to entrust an intern with, unless you can obviously build that trust up. And the importance of the work that they do for you. Whereas in the Premier League, you might have two or three guys doing a similar amount of work that it might be one person doing lower down. But also, like you say, the tools and the quality of the tool that they use, which comes at quite a cost, is impressive, and it makes presentations and the players' access to the information a lot easier and a lot more user-friendly for players. So that'd be the big difference. Certainly when I saw a couple of the presentations that were sent over before the Swansea game, I was in shock. It was almost like watching a match of the day.
Really?
Match of the day punditry show. But yeah, I mean, we've got the access now. The quality of footage, again, is not as good as it is in the Premier League, which is a stumbling block massively. But you just get on with it. You just have to explain to players a little bit more than maybe you'll have to do.
And the cure for that is you just have to get into Premier League and you'll be fine.
So yeah, exactly.
In the media, kind of as I've already mentioned, and stuff we talk about a lot on with Football IQ, is things like expected goals kind of coming into people's general vocabulary about football. Is this something you guys look at? Is that something you put a lot of weight into, or is it more kind of individual statistics of players and the like?
What we use at the moment is more individual statistics. Things like expected goals come into play when we're going into a transfer window, for example. So the manager could use that, for example, sitting down with the chairman or in a recruitment meeting. If our expected goals is quite high, and I think it is at the moment in the league,
yeah.
We could say possibly, well, we might need to invest higher up the field. We're creating the chances. We're just not putting them away.
I think Ben Mayhew, who was our guest in the first pod, I think in his rankings, he has Oxford as the third team for expected goals in the league. And I think currently Oxford are 10th. So it seems like, you know, the statos, or the analysts have Oxford performing better than maybe the league table suggests.
Yeah, exactly. Massive. And I think it's important that we use that, and we do use it as a motivation for the lads as well, to tell them that we will create chances. You just need to keep digging in there for now. And like I say, going into the next transfer window, do we use that to recruit?
Definitely, great. And in terms of the match prep, when you're talking to players and you're preparing them for the game, Do you give them individual targets? Do you give the team targets? Do you say to your right winger, you've got to try and get in 9 crosses today? Or is it more of a case of, this is your position, you know, do the best you can, make sure you don't get, your man doesn't beat you?
So first and foremost, I think, again, coming back to the manager, he likes to simplify everything for people playing in positions, so they'll have 2 or 3 points that they have to achieve, but they won't be statistical points or numerical points that you can put into numbers.
Okay.
What we done at the start of last year, which ended up being very successful, was breaking the season down into 5-game blocks, and then using the stats that we get from our stats company, Stats, that was formerly Prozone and Amisco. They send us reports after every game and we database them. And talking at the start of the season with individual units, so centre-halves, full-backs, wide midfielders, central midfielders and centre-forwards, and goalkeepers. The goalkeeper coach will hate me that I just dropped that in the end. Goalkeepers are really important.
Wayne Brown, I think, Thursday. Yeah.
But sitting down at the start of the season and creating targets around the stats that we had, and we've got almost 3 years' worth of data now. So sitting down with centre-halves and saying, do we want to limit the amount of shots that teams have? And if they say yes, then I can sit down and say, well, maybe that doesn't necessarily have a significant effect on the result. So maybe should we look at crosses and quality of cross that comes into the box? Can we stop that? And it's using the metrics that we have got access to that are important with regards to the effect on result, because ultimately that's all we're all here for, is to win a game of football. And a lot of time when I hear analysts talking, they can cloud over the metrics that are important. And we've found certainly in League 2 and League 1 that there are a few key metrics, like I say, that do give the team a significantly greater chance of winning a game of football.
Can you tell us what they are? Would that be giving away secrets? That'd
be giving away secrets. I can tell roughly. So it'd be things like ground jewels and air jewels. We get stats back from Stats that say, that just give us a percentage score. So did we win more or less than the opposition?
Aerial duels and tackles? Because that's something we offer as well, that people can look up kind of what players, what their aerial duel win percentages or
exactly,
take on percentage.
Exactly.
Like that.
And that's one of the stats that time and time again, as the season goes on and at the start of the season, if you do have more than 50% ground duels or aerial duel wins, you give yourselves a massively significant greater chance of winning a game of football.
Does it frustrate you as a fan? Maybe this is my own being my own bonnet, but when you're watching, say, Monday Night Football, and they put up how many kilometres a player's run without really quantifying at all, or putting it in order of other players or something, or how many sprints a player's done without showing any kind of context, is that something that frustrates you, or do you think that's still useful information that you can use going forward?
I think it's useful information if you can come up with a context yourself, but I think for people that maybe don't understand the distance or for when you're just comparing a team as a whole, I think with more context it would be a lot more user friendly to certainly the public and to people watching. We've got Dave Jones, that's one of works on Monday Super Sunday and Monday Night Football.
Yeah.
I watch it every week.
Monday Night Football this season, I think, isn't he?
Yeah. And exactly. We have discussions over stats that...
He's a director.
He's a director at Oxford United. And we have discussion over stats that are important, that aren't important. And again, looking at like duels and stuff, they don't talk about that on Monday Night Football, but I feel like that might be a stat that does show importance and effect on result.
I couldn't agree more. And also you see people talking about pass completion rates, but you know, how much does pass completion rate matter if you don't know how many chances they've created or how many passes forward and things like that?
Exactly.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And moving slightly on to recruitment, because I think that's where we want to talk a bit, because with the January transfer window upon us, obviously it's an interesting time of year for that. Have you found that at Oxford, is it you play a style of football to suit the players that you've got, or do you find you go out and you try and get the players that you want to play a certain style of football?
I think, to be fair, we're in quite a good position to answer that question, because when the manager came in, we had players that didn't really fit his style of football. So we had to play a certain way to fit the players that were in at that time. And it wasn't necessarily a style of football that the manager wanted to play, but he had to use the players that he had at the time to just get almost get through to the next window.
Yeah. The results were tough, I think, in that.
Yeah, results were tough, including the 5-1 loss away at Cambridge live on Sky. Yes. Getting in and seeing your phone and all your mates saying, "Now, what a good job you're doing."
including the analyst at Cambridge probably as well.
Exactly. But that's one of the reasons as well why, having seen it firsthand and seen a manager come in, want to play away, but due to obviously the window being closed and wanting to give players a chance, and like you say, results weren't great. That's why I can never understand how managers get such a short short chance at a club when all they're really doing is picking a side and attempting to coach a team to play a certain way. But they have to have, well, for me, they have to have at least a season or 18 months, but as a minimum a season. But when you see, certainly in the Premier League and the Championship, managers that get 2, 3, 4 months, shocking.
You'd think that at that level of football, maybe the reason is that if you're a manager who's capable of managing the Premier League, you should be able to alter your style of play to suit the players that you've got, maybe more so than in the lower leagues, where actually you may not be as expansive in terms of your style of play, maybe?
Yeah, possibly. But a lot of managers, well, certainly some managers, have got a distinct style of play that they want to play. And they're often brought in under the pretense of, we want you to play that way. They'll have maybe given a presentation to the chairman, but then they don't get a chance to bring that type of player into play in that type, and they square pegs in round holes, really.
Yeah, of course.
But as I was going on to say, after the first transfer window and 6 months into the current manager's reign, we then started to recruit players that would fit into our style of play.
And what was the style of play that for those who haven't seen Oxford playing in the last couple of years, what's the kind of style of play that Appleton's brought into the club?
So a team that, I mean, I hate when I hear people say this, because I think everyone wants to play the same way, but a team that wants to dominate possession and play in the opposition's half and final third. So a team that can spend long spells of a game in the opposition's final third. Obviously, then you've got to have fullbacks possibly that want to get forward, wide midfielders that are capable of rolling off the line. But I think it's certainly nothing groundbreaking there. Everyone wants to play that way.
You want good players in good positions, basically.
Yeah.
If a look at the Oxford United team at the moment, and there may be some kind of familiar names to some Premier League fans out there. You've got the captain, John Lundstrom, played for Everton and played for some England youth teams. Ryan Ledson also came from the Everton Academy. Joe Rothwell was offered a new contract at Manchester United in the summer, which he turned down to sign for Oxford. Is it harder? I mean, I'm not sure what role you have in the recruitment process with them, but is it harder to do your due diligence on these players before signing them, or is there almost less of a risk because you know they've come from top academies?
It's not hard. I don't think it's harder doing due diligence on them, because a lot of the top academies, especially, I mean, Everton's quite impressive in the fact that it churns out men footballers, in inverted commas, as opposed to under 21 players who maybe aren't as aggressive or aren't as nurtured in the physical side of the game. But when you do go to a top club and players that have made it to under 21 level, you can put a good bet on that they're going to be good footballers and able to deal with the ball under pressure. But it is then about finding, are they the right person? Are they someone that you want? If you're going for a bad spell, can you count on them if they're going into a 50-50 tackle to come out with the ball? That is the more difficult part, like you say. But we've got a great scouting department at the club. Craig Dean, who's a head scout, has got an unbelievable knowledge of under-21s football and non-league football. And he's got a good understanding of whether players are right or if they fit into what we need. And he's done quite a good job so far.
Yeah, absolutely. Looks like. And, you know, what role do you have as the kind of the performance analyst, you know, probably more day to day in terms of the you know, you're looking at the performance of the teams. How much input do you have in the recruitment process?
So I'll get asked my opinion. I'll sit in on all the recruitment meetings, ask my opinion, certainly on players. I've got a much better understanding of players in League 2, League 1, the Championship, as opposed to under-21s or non-league players, just because that's the football that I watch. But the gaffer's very aware that I do spend my day watching games of football, and I'll see people that impress me that won't. But we've got a head of technical analysis as well, Mark Thomas, who's technical recruitment, sorry, who compiles an unbelievable database, and anyone who loves stats would love to get into it.
Our next guest then.
Yeah, he could be. He's not as good looking as me, but he's better with Excel. But he's got this unbelievable database that at the drop of a hat he can pull up a spider diagram or find stats on an individual player that's played first team football. And I think that's one tool that's certainly given us a better opportunity at finding the diamonds in the rough, if you will, or players that will give us a good return on investment.
It's interesting you say that. Looking through, you know, I'm not going to be too rude about Oxford's recruitment in recent years, but because it's obviously been very good. But something that fans of kind of all football can relate with is trying to get players from, find the kind of the best players from maybe weaker leagues and bring them into kind of maybe a stronger league and hoping they're going to perform well. If you look at, say, the Dutch Premier League, for example, you've seen countless players come over from Holland into Premier League and really struggle, and then you get the odd Luis Suarez, who obviously is incredible. Oxford have in recent years looked further afield for players. I know Pat Hoobin was someone who came in having scored an absolute hatful of goals for Dundalk, which didn't work out. A couple of players on the team at the moment who are brought in from Scotland. How do you weigh up these kind of differing leagues? Is there a way of quantifying how they compare to the league, or is it just you're looking at talent and talent alone?
It's a lot of it is talent. So like I say, there'll be a lot of statistical information given to the manager from Mark, who looks after that side of things. The manager's very heavy on character references. So what is the player like? What's the person like in and around the training ground? Is he good when he's out in the community? But sometimes it just doesn't work out. I mean, the Pat Hoobin one got everyone at the club excited looking at the amount of goals that he'd scored. When you see the type of goals as well, certainly in League Two, you'd think, yeah, he's going to score a hatful here, especially with the chance that we created. Someone who can just pin centre-halves down when he's in the air and things like that.
And to reiterate, this is Dundalk, who are now, you know, just had an amazing European spell.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah. So it's they're a side that can compete. They're not a they're not a pup side. So there's not, we don't quantify it in respect of like the way an Instat index might work, where they give a certain more of a weighting towards a stat if you're playing in a higher league or not. We don't do that because, again, when you do find the ones that do work, they're just playing at a lower league for a reason that might not be something they can control.
Yeah.
But it comes down to the player's mentality and whether they fit in or not. And I wish there was more of a scientific way to say that, but a lot of the time it does work out, but sometimes when it doesn't work out, you can't put your finger on it, and you can go into detail of, well, are they living right? Are they homesick? Do they enjoy training? Do they enjoy being around the lads? There's a million one factors, but sometimes it just does not work out.
And as I said, with the January window here, having worked at a club through what must be kind of four or five windows now, mid-season windows, what are your opinions on it? Is it a good thing for football, do you think, or do you think it's quite disruptive to a squad?
I think it's a good thing for the teams lower down, because we can't have a squad size that maybe the manager might like or that we'd like to if finances wasn't a constraint. So I think it's important because, like I've said earlier, players go through good patches in form, bad patches in form. And a lot of the time, thankfully it's not at this club, but a lot of the time managers, they need the next one to be a win. They're not given the time to go and win a string of games.
Yeah.
So I think it's a good thing for lower down. I do think, in my personal opinion, it's important for the players that you've got in the squad that you're not allowed to loan window to window, because it does aid in team cohesion. And it stops, for example, players coming in and kicking someone else out of a position that they might have, if they're given another chance, might be able to do it there. So I think that's a good thing.
Have you been looking forward to this window? I think probably in the position Oxford in, probably not. Probably more scared of players going out the door rather than coming in, maybe.
But. Yeah. I mean, it's a risk that one of our important factors in recruitment is, especially if we're spending the chairman's money, is that the player does have a return on investment value. And there's always that risk, like we had with Kemar Roof last year, that when you do bring a player in, he's going to leave when the window opens. So I suppose in that sense as well, it's good that players can't go window to window, because you don't end up losing your best players. Yep. But it's always a risk when you bring players in and you're doing well, and we understand that we're not Man United or Chelsea, sadly, so we can't afford to keep players. Yeah, exactly.
I was just about to ask about Kemar Roof. Lots of Leeds fans will be listening, and also Callum O'Dowda, who is another player who left in the summer to go to Bristol City. Two players you must know very well and have worked with a lot. And obviously they're a fair way into their kind of new careers at their new clubs. But I was just wondering if you could give us a bit of an insight. I'm not going to ask who's better or who's going to go further, but obviously two exciting talents. Just about the two players and kind of, are you surprised to have seen them make the step up, or do you think they can go even further in the game?
No, not at all. I think both of them have the manager to thank a lot, Michael Appleton. Certainly before he came in, I don't think Callum was given the opportunities that he deserved. Both of them are so quick. Both of them came back every pre-season and they look like they'd worked their absolute socks off. They both have a real burning desire to play at the highest level that they can play at, which is why I was so proud when Callum got into the Republic of Ireland squad, and obviously Kemar making so many appearances in his first goal for Leeds.
And why didn't Callum go to France? All the Irish fans are asking. It's unbelievable.
Well, I was watching a couple of the Irish games and I thought, he could be chucked on here last 15 minutes, especially a little bit of pace to run in behind stretch teams. But listen, I'm not going to argue with, certainly not with Roy Keane.
No, exactly. And as a football fan yourself, I mean, how, looking at this window, who are the players around kind of at the top end of the English, kind of the tiers of the Premier League and the Championship, who are the players that really catch your eye? Are there any that you're a specific fan of at the moment?
Well, it hurts me to say it because I'm a QPR fan, but Diego Costa, he just watching him, and I've seen so many players try and play that number nine role on their own without support and struggle with it, or give centre-halves an easier time, but I can't stop watching him, and the way that he bullies centre-halves, and he can maintain possession when his team are trying to get out the pitch, which gives them an easy out, especially in the formation they're playing with 3-4-3, which I'm a big fan of as well, to be fair.
Yeah,
we've got the players.
what about the 3-4-3? Why do you think that's working so successfully for Conte?
I just think that you see lots of teams pack central areas now, and there's loads of statistical data out there about the most important areas to command boxes 2 and 5, I think it is, which are just wide areas. And when you've got a 3-4-3 and you've got three centre halves that you trust, you can really create overloads in wide areas that teams just can't handle, especially when you're playing against wide midfielders that maybe aren't as switched on defensively as a lot of opposition teams might like. I just think it gives you a great chance of dominating wide areas and putting balls into the box. And when you've got the quality of Costa and
Hazard, well,
just all of them,
there was that goal. I mean, I don't know. I'm sure you saw it. There was a goal that Hazard scored against Manchester United, where I think Alonso's sheer presence just on the wing can baffle Valencia so much.
Exactly.
That created space inside. Is that something that you guys, in terms of formation, is that something that would be deliberate in your opinion? Or is that just...
I think so, massively, yeah. If you're taking the concentration away from the defender, he doesn't know whether to come or to stay. If he comes, you just pop it past him. If he stays, you don't score yourself. That's what I did. And that's what I mean. It's just, it creates doubts in opposition players' minds. It just makes it more difficult for players to play against. And when you're doing that, you can do as much analysis as you like, or looking at patterns of play and stuff. But when you get into 2v1, certainly in the professional game, you're more often than not going to come out.
I'm sure, obviously, as a performance analyst, you have quite a big role to play in getting players out of slumps in form. And Costa is someone who certainly had a pretty big slump of form last season. Hazard is someone else who's had the same. I mean, how are you going about trying to get a player who you know is talented, who you know has got it in him, but just isn't for some reason firing? What would be your role in bringing him back?
I think as a performance analyst, you just first and foremost talk with the manager and what he wants, but showing them their good stuff. I know it sounds obvious, but we work with a psychologist at Oxford as well, and players like watching themselves. They like watching themselves do good things. They like watching themselves celebrating with other teammates. It's certainly an aspect of performance analysis that can be used to pull players out of slumps, and just really using it to simplify their game. Even at the top, I mean, I've never worked with top Premier League players. Hopefully someday, but I think when they're going through a bad spell, just simplifying the game. Can you keep possession for us? Can you pass to someone with the same colour kit as us? Can you get in the box? Can you get across people when the cross comes in? And it's as simple as that. And then obviously once players start playing with a bit of confidence, I mean, we had it last year where we were playing with so much confidence, I was almost scared for opposition teams coming to play against us, because we were going into games knowing that we were going to win. And when you get like that, there's nothing that can really stop you. And it makes your life a lot easier as well as an analyst. When you're going through a bad patch, or we've just come out of not a really bad patch, but a poor run of form, and everyone wants to analyse things in so much more detail than when you're winning games. And often it comes down to it might be a bad refereeing decision, or your keeper's maybe chucked one in, or your centre half hasn't gone up and won a header that he would have 9 times out of 10. But like I say, everyone wants to get into more detail and analyse it in so much, which I suppose is the right thing to do. But
does that mean that you personally feel more at fault when there's a loss rather than, you know, like you've achieved something when there's a win?
Yeah, massively, massively. I think losses hurt a lot more than wins feel good, even though wins do feel good. you always, I think every analyst in the country and well, every coach will probably go home and do the same thing. I speak to the physio and the fitness coach at the club as well, and they do the same thing. You go home and you think, is there something I could have done right there? Should I have told him that? Should I have noticed that? And again, you probably don't look at your own performance as much. I mean, I try to do it after every game, but you don't do it as much after a win. You don't look at the things that you did well. So I suppose that's just human nature, but...
And do you find, I mean, we spoke earlier about how in the Coventry game they turn up with a holding midfielder, which you weren't expecting. Do you find it's part of the game trying to surprise your opposition as well? Is that part of it? Or is it more a case of just looking at them and not worrying too much about what you're going to do, leaving that to the gaffer?
Yeah. I mean, I think it's a part of the game. But like I say, the manager at the club is really so much about us, and it's about what we do. He'd much rather play a team that everyone knows how we're going to play and just play it well, as opposed to trying to surprise the opposition. But I sometimes feel like it's a battle between myself and the opposition managers about like a game of chess, who's going to hold their nerve longest. But when it comes off, it comes off well when you do get things right. And you win a game of football and you're prepared in the week for a certain style of play, it feels
good. So finally... It sounds like a pretty full-on job. I mean, do you have any time off? Is your time off just spent watching more football?
No, I think time off's always spent watching more football. I've spoke to a few analysts, and when they'll tell you that they're still working, you always think, oh, is that giving you more of an advantage than us then? So you always feel like you can get another game in, or you can go through a match stats and see was there a positive trend or a negative trend there that you can possibly pull out. So I think it's a bit of a skill being able to just go, no, like, relax now, you've done your work. But it's certainly not easy to do. It doesn't make having a girlfriend or a family life any easier.
Well, I don't think anyone listening will be in any way cutting you any slack there, because I think certainly I found it absolutely fascinating. So just for anyone out there listening to this, thinking this is something that they'd want to do, do you have any advice for people who are looking at moving into being an analyst at a club and how they should go about getting into it?
Well, I get asked this question quite a lot, to be fair, but I wouldn't say there's any standout golden rule or anything that will guarantee you getting into a football club, because it is difficult. There's only 92 professional football clubs that you can get into. But first and foremost, being good on things like Excel is always, it's always going to stand you in good stead. But for me, the most important thing is that you're willing to work hard and that you are willing to give up your time. And secondly, and for me, the most important thing is that you do have a good relationship with your coaching staff and with the players, and being able to be honest with them without thinking that you've offended them. Being able to have honest discussions with like your manager, and just being a good person. I done a talk in university and they asked the same question. I said, just be someone that people want to be around. Don't be the geek that's sitting behind the laptop. I think every club needs that, but be someone that people like to be around, because ultimately they're coming into work every day and they want to be around you. I suppose that's probably correct in any line of work, but just being a good person, be upbeat, be positive.
So thank you very much, Dan, for coming on and being the guest on the third ever episode of the Football IQ podcast.
It's been a privilege. Thanks for having me.
I've been George Ellick, and please tune in next time for what will be another Football IQ panel show. Thank you very much.